Hey, podcast listeners, Michael Shelley here. In June, just a few months ago, I had Greg Calbee on the program, and the plan was to play some music and talk about his career in the mastering world. And what happened is we ended up talking and playing zero music. I did play some of his work leading up to the interview, but during the interview, we just talked for a solid hour. It went by in 2 seconds, and it was just one of those interviews where I didn't know what to expect, and people really reacted to it, which is super interesting because mastering is something that a lot of people just are not aware of yet. So every recording, it's a part of the release process for every record. So it was interesting to sort of talk about that and try to make it interesting to people. And I was just happy that there was so much positive reaction, partly I think just because Greg Calbee is one of the nicest guys in show business. So if you want to listen to that interview, it's from June 11th, 2016, and I would listen to it before this one if that's possible. So it went so well, we decided to come back and try to actually play some music and talk about it, which is what we did this week, and it's pretty self-explanatory. I want to remind you that, Carl Blau is coming up next week. He's got a beautiful new record called Introducing Carl Blau. Some other things on the horizon, so keep checking WFMU.org/Michael for the list of upcoming guests. So Greg Calbee, check out sterling-sound.com for his list of 8,000 records he worked on. Here's my chat with the super nice guy, Greg Calbee. Hey folks, all right, Greg Calbee is here, and we just played something off of New Sensations, a record that Greg worked on. I'm kind of looking for a date on this. I don't see one, but we started talking about Lou Reed, who is sort of a notoriously hard to get along guy. If you missed it, on June 11th, Greg was here. We talked for an hour about his entire career, how he sort of got in, always interested in entertainment business, and he was driving. He had driven a truck, and someone said, "Can you drive a truck?" And now he is one of the premier mastering engineers of all time in the whole world. And so we spoke about it all for about an hour in June. But we had meant to play a lot of records, and we didn't really get around to it. So this week, I want to welcome Greg back and hope that we can play some records. Good morning, Greg. How are you?
Pretty good. Love this part of Jersey City. It's always a little treat to come over here, and love seeing all the gigantic amounts of records and CDs that you guys have in there. It really, it's a big smile. I love going into anybody's house that has that. But you know, it's just to realize how many things we've had the opportunity to be, that I've been a part of, and as a fan, way more as a fan to be exposed to in my lifetime. It's just it's staggering. And what did somebody tell me? There's 130,000 albums a year coming out now.
Oh, my God.
So just when you thought you had enough.
Right? That's a lot of records. You've worked on 8,000, roughly, give or take, and you're still as busy as ever, I guess. Is that right?
I mean, I am as busy as ever, but the album format is changed, and the process by which people release albums is different now, because I think one of it has to do with budget, and another it has to do with attention span. But, whereas my days for many, many years were taken up by doing an album, like usually one album a day, when I come into work now, I have one artist sending me 3 songs, another 2 songs, another 3 songs from an EP that's going to come out before the album I did 2 months earlier, all kinds of plans of getting fans interested. Some people kind of just testing the water, investing some money and doing a couple of songs and seeing if they get any attention. And if they do, then they move on to the rest of the album. If not, they try something else.
So what percent of your work is albums?
Now I would say it's more like 50%, 40 or 50%, whereas it used to be basically 100%. If there were singles, it would be a single off the album,
right,
or a single that would be on the album that would come out later on. But, you know, the EP format, I mean, everything is just so crazy now because of streaming. Everybody out there who has a huge record collection and then never uses it and just streams everything, which would be some people, maybe even the person talking to you right now. I mean, it's like, am I going to get up off my chair at my computer and actually walk over to my albums and pick one out, or am I just going to sit here and just jack around?
Click two buttons, yeah.
Yeah, and hit two buttons, you know. So.
Well, let me ask you a question. When you master a record, do you do something different because in mind you think someone's going to be listening to it on Spotify? I mean, is there a different technical approach, or do you do more than one master?
You don't do more than one master, but actually your question is a profound question.
Goes another hour.
Without realizing it, which we could spend an hour on, because what's happened with streaming is that streaming and playlists have kind of taken the place of what it used to be like in the 70s when people would say to us, we want it to sound good on the radio, or we want it to be the hottest album it actually started in jukebox days with the hottest single. Because people would sit in a diner, and if you cut a 3-minute single and it was super loud, it would jump out of the speakers at the diner. I mean, I had producers would come in to me in the 70s and say, you know, I want this thing to jump in the diner. And it was really true. If you went to a diner sometime at 2 o'clock in the morning, a little bit out of it or whatever, and you started with the jukebox, some of those oldies would come on and they would just like leap out. It's like, wow.
I agree. Yeah.
You know, it was just incredible. And those were the ones that were cut hot. So now in the streaming days, it's actually incredible what's happened to mastering during the streaming era, because no matter how good a record sounds to an artist, if he's streaming it with other artists in playlists, which is what everybody's basically doing now, they're not too many people listening to albums top to bottom. They're picking their favorite song, they're making their playlist, they're sending the playlist to their friends. So I'll do an album that I think sounds great and the artist sounds great, and then 2 months later, this just happened this week. 2 months later, somebody will say, I was listening to this in this playlist and it didn't seem like it was loud enough. And this is the key element in mastering now, is not just to make the music sound either beautiful or dynamic or whatever in intense, but it has to kind of shape up to other loudness.
So do you A/B records with other stuff?
All the time.
So you make your own pretend sort of playlist.
All the time.
I've had to develop
a level, and it's been like the last 4 years spending so much time trying to develop that level, which will be the starting point where I get the most dynamic record and the loudest record. Invariably, there'll be someone who will say it's not loud enough, and then you have to kind of go past it. So, I would say there's 30% of the work that I do now, which I wish that I didn't have to do.
That's amazing. What percent of artists come to you and just say, I don't care about loudness? Make it sound good.
I would say maybe 20% would say that they don't care at all about it. And of those 20%, once they put it in playlists, they come back and say, well, I think I gave you the wrong instruction. So loudness is something you could have a panel discussion with five mastering engineers for a day.
It is really a hot issue. It's absolutely so. Just, I don't want to get caught up on this, but someone makes a record, they bring it to you, and they say, I want you to make this sound great. I want you to just make it better, and that's what you work on. Yeah. And then someone else brings the same record to you and says, it has to be the loudest record in the world. Mm-hmm. What is lost? What is the difference? What is lost?
The metaphor that kind of extended metaphor that I've always that I heard a few years ago, it always works for me, is that people have to understand that volume in a digital sense is the same thing as water in a fish tank. So if you shake the fish tank and the water hits the glass on top of the fish tank, that's as loud as it's going to go. Now, if you fill that entire fish tank up with water and shake it, the waves are only going to be like 2 inches or 4 inches. If you had it much less water in it, those waves would be up high. Compare that to dynamic range. So what you lose is dynamic range, what we in studios always call punch, dynamics and punch. So what invariably will happen, the louder it gets, like the bass, two things, bass and drums. Bass and drums are the things that suffer most. So the drums, instead of having that really deep whack that you get from like a tom-tom fill, a boom-boom, like a real deep tom-tom fill, or heavy snare cracks, those things end up getting held back. And what comes forward is the vocals and guitars and synthesizers. So the more guitars, vocals, and synthesizers sounds that you have, or ambient guitars that kind of fill the space, you have like it's kind of like wall of sound. But the thing with wall of sound, like the Phil Spector wall of sound, is that because of the way he recorded the drums were so dynamic in and of themselves, he had such a skill, he was able to create the wall plus have the drums being sounding dynamic. But if you looked at meters, you would see those drums actually were not dynamic, but they mm-hmm. another effect was put on them to make them more emotional.
Yeah, it's very interesting because when you talk to a person, you don't think, oh, that's got really quiet. You know, your ears are so good at compressing, you know, so that there's a whole trick to trying to make records sound like life. You know, I don't. All right, let's talk about Lou Reed for a minute. I played this record off New Sensations. Lou Reed, a notoriously not a people person, you know. Do you deal with Lou Reed working on this? Does he come in? Does he listen? Does he react?
Oh, Lou was a very keen listener in the days I worked with him, which was until the late 80s. I mean, I got the opportunity. What happened is I got the opportunity to redo for digital release the whole Velvet Underground catalog for Polygram. So he had to. He was on the list to be able to. To approve or not approve of the work, and I hadn't met him before that, and I hadn't done any of the records. The early Velvet's records were way before even when I was in the business. So I did a whole bunch of work, and he was very, very happy with the work. And coincidentally, when I was an assistant, I worked on his record Berlin, although I didn't deal with him directly. I dealt with Bob Ezrin, his producer at that point. That's when Lou had other producers working for him. So he was a keen listener. He was an audiophile. He was an intent. You know, Lou... Over the years, you know, he was a difficult person to work for, and the you know, the engineering community in New York, everybody has a Lou Reed story. But you know, the thing with Lou is that, and I've learned by having, you know, getting to know Laurie a little bit and having the opportunity to meet some friends of his. Lou is just a very intense artist. He was a pure artist. You know, engineers, when they talk to each other about maybe an artist who's a little difficult to work with, in too particular, we just use the word artist. And then when you say artist, it opens up a door of acceptance of that person as an artist, because the artist is always looking to improve, or things are very fluid to an artist. You know, you're not dealing with an accountant, you're not dealing with an attorney who's going to underline a sentence in a paragraph. You're dealing with an artist. And that, over the years, I've learned to, just in a conversation with people, how much of an artist they are, meaning how fluid is their feeling about their work and how sensitive they are to what they have done.
So his prickliness was never just a weird attack. It was always a defense about his process or something?
Well, it was. I had a situation with him where he came to the studio. I forgot which album it was, but after I had done six or seven albums for him in the Velvet era, and then... The Blue Mask and New Sensations, and I think there was another one back then. So I had a good relationship with him up to that point. And he came into the studio to listen to mixes the day before mastering. And I was listening to the mixes, and there was just something that didn't sound right. It wasn't a mastering session; it was just a listening session. And he and Fernando, his bass player, were on the couch, and they both fell asleep during the playback, which is not unusual. You know, they've heard it a million times, but they were sound asleep. When they woke up, I said to Lou, you know, Lou, I think there's something about this transfer or something that's not right. We got to look into it before the next session. And he said, well, no problem. He said, I'm booked in next week or whatever. The next day, I got to the studio, and the word was Lou Reed canceled the session. I didn't hear from Lou at all. And that was the last I ever saw of Lou in terms of working one-to-one with him. He actually took it to another place and found a good home for many, many years with Bob Ludwig up in Maine. But the thing that I heard about Lou is he was very superstitious. And when I told him that I heard something that wasn't wrong, it immediately put me into a different category. Now, at the time, this is like 25 years ago, whatever, you know, I was livid because I had done such good work for him and he was happy. And he didn't give me an opportunity to do what I could do to either fix
and you may
that
have been
thing.
Right, yeah.
Well, I think I was right. I think I know what happened, and but I never really got an opportunity. So, again, 25 years ago, I wasn't mature enough to understand what goes through an artist's mind, but I've learned over the years in working with many, many people that this is just something which is just you accept, and you just try to do your best. You know, I mean, I don't want to be too cliche about living in the moment, but just do the work that's in front of you. Don't be projecting, and you never really know why somebody, you know, I got to say, I've gotten credit for things that I had nothing to do with way more than I have gotten blame for things that I have done. So I just look at the big picture. And, okay. You know, when people tell me they love a record And I had nothing to do with that record other than transfer it. You know, I'll take it and, you know, make a That's career right. out of it. Thank you.
They delivered you a fantastic sounding record.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah. I want to talk about the Beatles. Have you got a big Beatles box set in front of you? I just saw the Beatles movie in the movie theater with my daughter and my wife.
How'd you like it?
In Montclair. We really had a great time.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not, we've already discussed this on the show, but it's, you know, for someone who's, obsessed. There's not a lot of new information or new points of view, but just to sit in a movie theater and listen to the Beatles for 90 minutes is a great thing. And there's a lot of funny, and it was ultimately very moving, I thought, just the brotherhood there and just the times changing. And that's something I'm always interested in. So let's talk about the Beatles.
Yeah.
Can you pick a track, first of all, that we can hear, something that you think sounds awesome? How, you know, somebody comes to you and says, you know, we want you to remaster all the Beatles, you know, the best selling, the most popular group of all time, period. Did they make you do any kind of an audition, or let's do a few tracks first, or did they give you instruction like, we want it to sound better, modern, worse, or just do what you want? And
no, excellent question. And this was a really an interesting project on many levels, and I hope that that comes through in what I'm going to tell you about the project. But I got to do the mastering for the U.S. LPs. Okay, so the Beatle LPs that were released in England, I think most Beatle fans know, they're different albums.
They all had 14 tracks.
They had more tracks. What happened was the Beatles, when they came to America, I think they ended up releasing like 6 albums in a year or in 14 months or something. And they were kind of concise versions of the British albums. The British albums always had more on them. And I remember, even as a fan, listening to British albums, and they always sounded a little tinny. They always sounded a little bit smaller. And over the years, I've learned why that was. But the American albums had different sequences. A whole bunch of songs had different mixes. A lot of songs like "She's a Woman" and "I Feel Fine" had reverb put on them.
Crazy reverb, basically by
an engineer in California at Capitol in California, which was not approved by them, and apparently they hated that. So what we attempted to do, and Steve Berkowitz, a good friend of mine, was the coordinator of this project, was the executive producer of this project, and I had worked with him on a number of things over the last 20 years, and Jeff Jones, who runs Apple, is a really good friend of mine, and know about my connection with John Lennon over the years, all the Lennon work that I've done, and, you know, so I was kind of in the flow. Jeff Emmerich I've worked with a number of times, so kind of in Beatle land a little bit, so it was kind of a natural thing for me and Steve to work on this project. But it was a very peculiar project because the American records were different records, and the American albums sounded different than the English albums. So if you were going to now release a box set of the American albums, do the American albums want to sound just like the English albums, just in a different order? Or do you want to give them a different texture or a different sound?
Meet the Beatles to me is an important record because my mom had it from when she was young. So that was the first record I ever saw as a little boy. But it doesn't even exist in real Beatles catalog.
Yeah.
So I want to relive Meet the Beatles sort of as I heard it.
Yeah.
So what was the final decision?
Well, technically, I had to tiptoe between a couple of different rationale. Number one, the material that I got to work with was not the original tapes.
Okay,
the original tapes are really kept under lock and key in England, and they really do not want to send these around. They're at Abbey Road. Abbey Road had already remastered everything for the first set of these in the English sequences. Okay, and all that digitization, which was done originally in 44.1 digital. So we now have in the high res world, things are slowly but surely being remastered in high resolution, and for people, labels to make a living doing that, and distributors to make a living doing that is another whole thing. With streaming on Tidal, for example, there's so many aspects to this. But basically, what I got to work with was Redbook, meaning 44.1 16-bit digital copies of what they did in England.
So CD.
CD quality.
But so they chose not to just resequence what they'd already done and put different covers on them.
No, because there was a whole bunch of stuff that were in the vaults in California for the American parts of these things, which were sporadic through the album. Some albums didn't have any of that. Some it was just England. But I had to listen to these and try to figure out how not to change them, but to kind of Americanize them a little bit. And what I found in listening to the English things was, strangely enough, exactly what I heard even before I was an engineer which was they were a little sterile. They were clean, but they were almost too clean. So I had to kind of come up with a way to kind of fatten up the sound, but not change the balances of the sound, because I didn't want people to listen to this and go like, wow, it sounds so different than the English, or it sounds so different. So it was actually a very delicate thing, but I was so thrilled. What I concentrated on basically was the McCartney bass sound. And I felt like it could, almost on every album, it could have been better. And better in the sense of being a little bit more elastic and a little bit more, a little richer. And in some cases, not necessarily a little louder, but a little bit more noticeable.
Let's hear a track. What have you done?
I'd like you to listen to Dr. Robert, and I just have to find it.
Sure.
So it would actually take a minute.
Take a minute. I want to remind everybody, Greg Kalby is our guest. He's mastered, 8,000 or so records. You can see a picture of him and look at his discography at sterling-sound.com. And he's going through the Beatles box set right now.
The thing that I wanted to mention about this, which was so thrilling to me, was that there was an English writer, and unfortunately, I didn't.
Is it in your car?
I didn't. No, it's not in my car. It's not here.
He's got an empty CD case.
Yeah, could play. We could play anything else. But it's just that Dr. Robert was just like such a revelation to me when I listened to it. But anyway,
is it all scary?
Any time you do anything for the audiophile, that audiophiles have a potential to listen to your work, it's always scary, because it's not so much the critic who's going to write, it's the blogs.
Being a fan, and how dare he?
I'm one of those guys, maybe like those actors that never see the movies that they're in. I'm just one of those guys who'd never read any of those blogs, because there's just so much about what goes on technically. I'm looking through number nine. Anyway, so this writer did a two. He did a two issue. It was probably a total of about 10 pages critique of the work that I did on the American albums, and he said it was by far the best bass sound that McCartney's had in the digital era. And the thing that I loved about that was the fact that that's exactly what I was trying to do.
Yeah.
And the work that we do is usually so subtle that people usually...
So he picked up on that without anyone cluing him into
absolutely.
It. Oh, that's great. Did you hear from McCartney at all?
No, I wouldn't. Just like I never talked to Bob Dylan, I never talked to Paul McCartney.
Let's hear this record. This is a remastered Beatles track, and I will listen for the bass here and see what we hear. More with Greg Kalby when we come back. I'm looking through you. Where did you go?
I'm looking.
the Beatles. I think that's Ringo on the organ. I don't remember. Greg Calvey is our guest. You were telling me off the air something about working on the Sgt. Pepper tapes.
Yeah, and like in 1997, we got a phone call from Jeff Emmerich that he wanted to remaster Sgt. Pepper. What was in 97? It was going to be the 30th. Was it the 20th or the 30th? 60, 70, 30th anniversary. Now we're coming up on the 50th. So this was a while ago. So this was going to be a remaster of Sgt. Pepper, and I was like, I was astounded. I mean, for me, this was like, you know, talk about the Holy Grail.
Sure, everyone's favorite album of all time.
Yeah. So Jeff comes in, and there's a guy, very proper English guy with a suit jacket and everything, and he has like an attaché case, and the attaché case contains the tape. And he took it out and gave it to me, and what he didn't realize was the night before, I had a nightmare. It was almost like an Alfred Hitchcock movie where I had this tape, the Pepper tape, on my machine, and I was working, of course, in the dream, how insane it was, on a balcony, and the tape flew off the machine, and it flew down into about six stories below, and it unraveled as it went down. So I had this, and I was so nervous about handling this tape, putting it on the machine. And the great thing about this session that I'll never forget was that when it was time for lunch, the guy, even though we were eating in the studio, we weren't leaving in the studio, he had me take the tape off the machine, he put it in back in the attaché case, and then he never took his eyes off it. He took him into the lunchroom. Wow. He had it in the case next to him. He came back in after lunch, put it back on the machine. So this was like handling like bullion, like God knows how much gold, you know. But that's what happens. I mean, if you're an engineer and you're touching these incredible, valuable
quarter-inch tape that somebody mixed down in 1967
yes,
or whatever.
That was the master. See, this is what most people don't understand about what's happening with digitizing old tapes and old masters. You could have what you think is the top 10 classic album of all time, and that tape may or may not exist. And if it does exist, people may or may not know where it is. And the source for all these things, getting to the source, is like so incredibly important. Finding it is sometimes almost impossible. I mean, sometimes they release these albums and then 6 months later somebody finds in the Netherlands a copy that was like an earlier generation than the one that was already used, and they have to reissue the whole thing.
Right.
It's a really interesting, technically it's really interesting, but people have to all understand that from the classic era, from the analog mix era, those tapes really will never sound like what they sounded like back in those days, because in the element of magnetism and what tape is and what magnetism is. I mean, I've had tapes that come in, it's the first generation tape, you put it on the machine, you compare it to an LP done in like 1977, and you go, what the hell happened to this tape? I mean, it's absolutely incredible.
It's just old, it's lost its mojo.
It could have been kept in the wrong kind of temperatures or change of temperature. I mean, tapes shouldn't be kept in a very hot environment. See, that's why if you're driving through the hinterlands of Kentucky and go to a record store and find a copy of your favorite record that's an original one, it'll never sound better than that. Just buy it. I mean, if it's $2, great. If it's $20, buy it.
Have you ever had to remaster a record from vinyl? Was vinyl the best original source you could find?
I don't think we ever mastered a whole album from that, but occasionally a track will come from something, and you have to, we don't really do the archiving stuff, noise removal, but, you know, there is software to take clicks and crackles off records, but yeah, occasionally that's all they have. I've done from cassette. Sometimes the cassette is the only source. I did, it was a number one record. The Go-Go's did a number one single, I think it was called Weekend. And the master of that was a cassette. It was a rough mix on a cassette.
Huh.
And we took the cassette and we transferred it to a regular tape. But you know, you just never know.
Because they said there's no better mix than this one.
No better. They couldn't make the mix any better than the rough that they did. In other words, they're in the studio. Everybody's finished playing. They kind of say, "Oh, going to mix tomorrow. Let's just take home something." They do a quick one, put it on the board, run it over to cassette, and listen to it at home. Then they come in like a week later, okay, let's really mix this, and they spend like days and days and days, and it doesn't sound as good as the cassette. So it really was a number one record.
That is amazing. Let's talk about the Ramones. 40th anniversary of the first Ramones album, and there's a new box set out with three CDs, and there's the mono, there's the stereo, there's outtakes, there's live, et cetera, et cetera. One of my favorite records ever, I remember when I was in junior high school, my brother brought this record home, and boy, I mean, you know, not the Steve Miller Band. You know what I mean? This is, and I still love the Steve Miller Band, but like, just the world opened, the door opened. Yeah. And I still love this record. So I want to listen, and I'm not, I mean, I have some preconceived idea here, but I want to listen to the LP that you originally mastered and the CD and see if we can hear any difference. I don't know if you want to put the headphones on. It might be helpful.
Sure. This is going to be really fascinating because if that is an LP, first run LP, so this is what I don't know what you have there, but I'll take a peek at it.
I think so because it's magic marker says 1976.
Yeah, yeah.
On
oh,
it.
Yeah. Okay. So this is
It's probably been played a billion times. So this is the original copy of the WFMU God in 1976.
It's fantastic. And I can explain. I have actually a very interesting story about this. But I'm
such
curious
a weird
to hear
record.
The difference
yeah.
between the.
I don't know. There's another pair of headphones right near the Beatles box. There. I think those are
okay.
Those are cranked and ready to go. All right. So I'm going to try to start them at approximately the same time, mm-hmm. so we can see what's going on here.
Turn me up.
There's a volume right under your chair there. Yeah, it gotta be loud.
Hey, let's go.
I mean, it's the greatest record ever, really. I mean, it's partly because it's perfect. You know what I mean? It's just every sound on it is great. Performance is great. All right, let's. Here's the CD. Oh, different.
Much better.
All right, here's the record again. Oh, it's not that different, is it?
Much more bottom on the new one.
I'm going to put them both. All right, that's that unity gain for the LP. That's pinning the meters. And there's the CD at unity also. Oh, it's pinning.
The pilot in the back seat. Listen to the snare drum. The snare drum got really puffy on the new one, like.
I don't know. What's your professional?
I like the new one much better. And this is you're really talking about two completely different eras of mastering and of transfer. I mean, this was a tape that came. This is a tape that came in with a couple of guys from my neighborhood in Queens who walked in with these filthy pants and busted up leather jackets and, you know. God rest their souls, man. One of the ugliest bunch of guys that ever walked into a studio. I couldn't believe it. Never heard of them. They walk into the studio, and I'm hearing what you hear for the first time. I never heard of the band.
Mind blown.
And what happened was they really wanted to listen really loud, and I turned it way, way up. And at that point, I was really new to this equipment that I had. Don't forget, I'm also like 24 years old at this point. I have like 3 years of experience. So it's not like I'm this, you know, like I am like now this senior guy who's like been around. I mean, I didn't really know that much, truthfully. And they turned it way up. And then everything started getting, like I said, man, they recorded this really dull. And I started to make it brighter and brighter and brighter. And it wasn't getting any brighter. And I realized that we basically blew the speakers. It was an electrostatic speaker, electrostatic head. And they were so happy that they blew the speakers.
Mission accomplished.
They were so, and I heard from friends of theirs that they called up after the session. They thought it was the greatest thing in the world that they blew up the speakers at Sterling Sound. That was the mission accomplished, right? But like what you just heard is the same reaction that I have a lot of times when I listen to old Police records. It's like there's a starkness. There's almost like a primitiveness about that original record that the new one, although the new one is more powerful with the bass, it's much better. There's much more now musically.
Whether if you
listen to one or listen to the other, if your body's going to rock a little bit differently, which one is going to sound more like when you saw them? When you know, did you see them a lot?
Never saw them.
Oh, I mean, it was the most astounding. When you caught them on a good night, I saw them like three or four times, but I saw them one time at the Academy of Music, which was absolutely amazing. 25 minutes, you can't. They couldn't possibly do more than 25 minutes. How he could play the bass like that. So I kind of like both of them. I don't take any credit for the 1976 one, other than the fact that I was able to transfer it onto the lacquer.
But a lot of the songs, the bass is all the way on one side, right? And the guitar is all the way on one side. Is that a particular problem for mastering a record?
It's not a problem for mastering. It's a big problem for getting onto vinyl. I don't remember having the problem. Sometimes when they do that, if the miking is a little bit strange, you get lift outs. You get something which won't track. In other words, you get a skipping record, which is the nightmare of all vinyl. But I'd be curious to know, if you played that for a whole bunch of people, who would like which one. But I think the new one is a modern take. It's a much more compressed, obviously much more compressed. Everything's like very forward. And if you really listen to the instruments, the drum really has a different personality. On the snare drum really has a different personality.
Yeah, so listen to it. There's the vinyl. I'm surprised the vinyl is still in good shape.
Yeah.
It must have been played a billion times.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, the bass in your ear, it's great. I'll tell you, I know I don't have your job because I don't hear a huge, huge difference. I mean, I feel it a little bit, but I don't.
But the bass, to me, the bass on the new one is great. I mean, and he was such a great bass player. I mean, in the shows, I mean, that he was like the magic trick, I think. I mean, the songs was just so cool. But
I do think every band has a sort of secret ingredient,
yeah.
And it may be the bass in the
Ed Stasium, who he didn't mix that album, but he's done four or five. He's a really good friend of mine, lives in San Diego. I'm actually going to give him a ring this week.
He's been a guest on the show, too.
Ed has?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. He's a Jersey guy originally. He's had a great, great trajectory.
I think his first record was Midnight Train to Georgia.
He did a lot of R&B when he started out, yeah.
What a great way to start. Greg Calbi is our guest. He's worked with the Ramones and Eric Carmen and Bruce Springsteen and David Bowie and the Talking Heads and Patti Smith and Tom Petty and Aretha Franklin, Todd Rundgren. I mean, everybody, like we said, 8,000 people. Tell me a record you have in your bag. You brought some that you want to.
Well, you
can tell
actually,
me a little
bit. If we want to loop back a little bit to the discussion about streaming and volume, there's a record here that was done by Australian Kevin Parker. Kevin Parker is Tame Impala. And if you could just put the second track on that. This album, and I have to say, all the years that I've been doing the work, which is more than 40 years, I don't think that I got more work by having my name on a record than I have from doing this Tame Impala record. And the thing about this record was all the work on the record was done by a brilliant producer engineer named Dave Friedman, who works up in upstate New York. MGMT, Tame Impala, Dave Friedman, Fridmann, is just a very, very in-demand producer, and he has come up with a formula for making his mixes louder than basically almost anybody's mixes in the indie rock genre. You know, hip-hop records are routinely much louder because everything's sampled, and you can kind of technically you can do that. But this particular record, you might want to play. Actually, I think the second track.
And what's the artist's name?
Tame Impala, Australian guy named Kevin Parker. And seriously, I've never had more response from the engineering community bringing me work than because my name was on this record, and it was all as a result of Dave Friedman's work.
His mixing.
Very little. We'll be right back.
did you ask this guy, what are you doing? I mean, what is your secret? The producer?
Yeah, I've asked him, and I've asked people that work with him, and he has a collection of analog outboard equipment, which he's learned how to overdrive and get a certain type of distortion that's able to be put down like super loud and super musical. He's extremely creative. But what happens is if you play this CD in a playlist against other things, it blows everything away. Well, it's much louder.
Okay, as soon as it kicked in,
yeah.
I had to pull the fader way down. So
yeah.
There's what we talked about, unity gain. It's like zero, sort of. It's
yeah.
not on home equipment, but on a radio station. So if you put... Am I right that's where the fader is working at its most efficient?
Yeah.
So, but if I put this here, I mean, So what should the relationship be to a CD, to Unity Gain? What?
The technical thing is that in digital terms, they're all the same level. It's just that he's got this in some other way. He was able to come up about 5 or 6 years ago. He was able to come up with a way to make his mixes sound much louder than anybody else's mixes.
But this is louder. I mean, I cannot put the fader more than, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, it's unbelievably loud.
So what happened was, and this was in the early stages of a tremendous amount of effort going into software developers developing compression schemes to be able to make records loud, because everybody wants loud. But this became kind of like the bar of loud.
Huh.
So now I've had to incorporate tools like plug-in tools in my computer to be able to get my stuff as loud as this. So in other words, the producers kind of push the bar forward, then musicians kind of hear this and find that they find that more impactful, and because that's more impactful, when they do what they can't do is they don't know how to do it in the mix, so they bring it to me. Telling me, do what you did with Dave Friedman's thing, but I didn't do anything with Dave Friedman's thing because Dave figured out how to do it. Now I had to figure out how to do it.
Well, one of the problems is, though, you know, somebody hears this or they hear a Public Enemy record or something that just sounds amazing, but they don't know how to do it. So they come up with a version that's just loud, or it's missing what you said, that this producer has this ability to make it musical and loud. So if you're missing the musical part, then you just have loud.
That's called ruining a record, and that's that's what sometimes that I need to ruin somebody's record to satisfy their their insecurity about their record not being loud enough. See, loud is just only one aspect of the art of recording. It's just one aspect. But
yes.
It's just taken, because of the way people are exposed, being exposed to the public and to their fans, it's very, very demanding for someone to be able to put out something that they feel is not loud in a playlist and say, well, this is great if you just turn it up. So it's too technical and maybe too boring to talk about, but the concept rules what everybody does, and including the mixers, the mastering guys, and subsequently the artists. And also, in a way...
It's sad.
The style of music kind of lends itself for loud. In other words, people imagine the music with this kind of in mind. So all these really hyper compressed records, and you see the band live, and they actually doing the same thing that they did on the record. And you know, there's another thing recently that's really been strange is the amount of reverb that people are putting on the record. The atmospheric, and I always say it's like what the band sounds like when you're in the bathroom at Terminal 5. That's what people want their records to sound like. They want them to sound like that. They feel somehow it gives a feeling of like pandemonium, some kind of, you know, you're out late, the music's bouncing off the walls, there's this whole excitement, this thing. It's just, you know what I mean? Like the technical is
life
kind of
is imitating art.
And that's why I'm fortunate that my client base is not just made up of this kind of music, which is super challenging for me. But I also, you know, I also do a bunch of jazz records every year, and a bunch of, you know, rock records and blues records and everything. So, you know, I also have this Bob Dylan project which I worked on, which I thought maybe at some point
we could
jump over to.
Yeah, I mean, so again, Bob Dylan. This is like, you know, in America, there, I can't think of a catalog that is sort of more respected than, I mean, some maybe should be, but it's Bob Dylan, for crying out loud. So again, did you get to work with the actual tapes when you?
Well, we did 16 albums, and with some of the albums, they had the original tape. Free Will and Bob Dylan, I had the original 1964 master in my hand,
oh boy,
mono version, fantastic. With some of them, they were copies that were there's a guy who works for Legacy named Didier, who's a researcher who actually went out and found best possible version. There was one album, and I kind of don't feel like saying which one, but there was one album which they actually had to remix because they only had three track. They didn't have any two track sources on this particular record, and they had to take the three tracks and they had to pan them and make them exactly like the original. The idea with Bob Dylan is you want it to sound like the original or an improvement on the original. It's not as delicate as the Beatles stuff, but it's still, you don't want to throw something different out. But there was an album that Dan Lanois produced called Oh Mercy, and there's a song on here called Ring Them Bells. And I'll tell you, you know, we put that on it. It's absolutely a beautiful Lanois production. I got to work with Dan very early on in his career when he was engineering for Brian Eno, and Brian had a record deal with Passport Records with some of his ambient stuff, and Dan was engineering with his brother, Bob, up in Hamilton, Ontario. And this was one of the records in the series of records that I did for Dan that was done digitally. It was in the early digital era, so it was actually mixed to DAT.
Oh, my.
So in the original digital era, there was a, I don't know how to want to say it, was like a vibe. Like if something's digital, you got to keep it digital. Just stay in the digital domain. It was like digital. It's really an incredible thing because just 10 years later, digital was totally put down as, you know, sterile and not natural and everything. But in the beginning of digital, people were so intrigued by the no hiss factor and, you know, just the convenience factor of the CDs and comparing CDs in the car to cassettes and everything. You know, it was like digital. So the first time this came out, it was like digital only. And I was really not able to give it the life that I was able to give it in this one. It's too late to find it now. I don't have an original.
So you kind of warmed it up a little the second time.
Warmed it up tremendously. Well, similarly, you know, that's why with that Ramones that we just listened to, the warming thing, I mean, if I was remastering, I wasn't given the opportunity to do anything on this Ramones reissue, and it must have been a lot of fun, especially if they had the original tapes. But I probably would have gotten somewhere in between what you heard. You know, get the bass a little bit better, but leave a little bit more of the more primitive sound of drums, which was part of the sound of that record, you know. So, but with this, with Ring Them Bells, if you can...
Let's hear it. Yeah. Bob Dylan, Ring Them Bells, and Greg Calvi is here, and back after this.
Ring them bells, ye heathen from the city that dreams. Ring them bells from the sanctuaries, cross the valleys and streams. For the deep and the wide, and the world's on its side. And time is running backwards, and so is the bride. Ring them bells, St. Peter, where the four winds blow. Ring them bells with an iron hand so the people will know. Oh, it's rush hour now on the wheel and the plow. And the sun is a-going down upon the sacred cow. Ring them bells, sweet Martha, for the poor man's son. Ring them bells so the world will know that God is one. For the shepherd is asleep where the willows weep. And the mountains are filled with lost sheep. Ring them bells for the blind and the deaf. Ring them bells for all of us who are left. Ring them bells for the chosen few who will judge the many when the game is through. Ring them bells for the time that flies, for the child that cries when an innocence dies.
Ring them bells, St. Catherine, from the top of the roof. Ring them from the fortress before the lilies.
Yeah, it doesn't sound digital. I remember, I think it's the whatever the big breakthrough record for 10,000 Maniacs was, is like the most digital sounding, you know, uh-huh. record. Just everything is like a broken piece of glass. You know, it's just hard to take that. So, do you hear from Bob Dylan? Does he pick up the phone?
No.
Hey, Greg, thanks so much.
No,
have a cigar.
I've done probably 20 albums, 20 Bob Dylan albums, and I've never spoke to him. There's a guy named Jeff Rosen who's a very, very good guy who's Bob's advisor and deals with all his production stuff and everything, and we always go through Jeff. Bob is he's a listener and he cares, but I never had an opportunity to meet him or speak with him. But we just like it when Bob is happy, and that's what you want to hear.
You picked out the record "Damn the Torpedoes" from Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers. This really was kind of a breakthrough album, 1979 for Tom Petty, but also for the way rock records sounded on the radio.
Yeah.
I think, you know, after this, the idea of having those drums that are in your face and, you know, it's not that kind of, I don't know, the hippie thing totally gone. And, you know, guys like John Cougar and those kind of fatter records came after this.
Yeah.
So what can you tell
me
about
Tom
Petty?
The reason I wanted to play this is because we talk about compression. In the CD era and the loss of dynamics or whatever, but this is like the exact opposite. This is like we're talking about the late 70s, talking about probably one of the top recording engineers and mixers on the planet, Shelly Yackas, who was the engineer on this, along with Jimmy Iovine as the producer. And, you know, they did this at the Studio Record Plant where I originally worked.
I think Shelly Yackas had been making records from the 60s, am I
yeah.
right?
Yeah, Shelly worked at A&R back in the 60s. He actually recorded a whole bunch of Astral Weeks, Van Morrison. He recorded those big hits by the Raspberries, Please Go All the Way, which anybody who was around that era, those records, talk about exploding.
Oh, my God.
And Shelley's thing was that he wanted to mix it so that it sounded in the way he mixed it. He wanted to sound it the same way on the radio that in the studio, as in the studio. So he really learned about compression, and he learned about how to get things to sound loud but still have dynamics. The guy's a genius. He's a great guy. I owe a lot of my career to him for not only for the mentoring that he did with me, but he actually saved me from getting fired when a very intense practical joke went awry. I would have been only
what?
2 years. Yeah,
tell
yeah.
it, tell it.
A friend of mine and I partook of maybe something that was a little bit stronger than we thought it would be, and we got a little crazy. It was during a period where we had fire extinguishers in the studio, which were frequently set on some of the artists, like the New York Dolls. One time we got the New York Dolls covered with the fire extinguisher stuff. Anyway, so a friend of mine, my friend Tom and I, got a little frisky one night and set off the fire extinguishers, and little did we know that one of the people in the building saw the smoke coming out of the door and called the fire department, and the fire department came in and destroyed the front door of the studio, along with messed up a whole bunch of stuff in the studio, and Shelley saved my job. He basically saved my job because he knew that I worked with him in the cutting room, and his sound had to be mastered properly. But it didn't have to be mastered properly by somebody like me, who was only around for like a year or two. It had to be mastered by him working with me and me working the controls of the cutting lathe, which he didn't do, but the ear work. So this is what
he needed you.
He needed me because I knew the way he worked, and I was like another set of hands for him. But it was very, very instructive. Basically, that the greatest engineer could be so insecure and constantly striving for better. And you know, Don Henley, Age of the Innocents, Boys of Summer. That's Shelly Yackas. I mean, if there's a Hall of Fame of rock producers, he would be, I think, in the top 2, 3, 4, whatever. I mean, just one of the super greats. And if you play this and listen to the drums, if we play that tune, don't do me like that, and just listen to the drums. I would go when I was an assistant for Shelly. I would go into the studio, and he would have me sit at the drum kit and just bang on. Okay, first it would be like floor tom, boom, 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 boom. I'm talking about 5 minutes, 10 minutes, and he's working the dials. You know, people don't understand, in those days, the budgets allowed for that kind of care, that kind of that amount of time on care is just outside of only the top quarter of 1% of people can make records with that budget now. Everybody else, the drummer will go in, the guy sets up the microphones. We got to do 2-3 songs today. You know, if you have a great engineer, he'll do a great job, but he's not going to spend a day or 2 days setting up the drum mics the way Shelley would do. So these things didn't come, they came with a cost. You know, the record sounded great in the 70s. Young people who love classic rock and who can feel that. And as I mentioned before, every era has its own set of things that go into the creativity. And now we're in a different era. But in that era, there were people who really had the money and made a living being perfectionists. And
but again,
the recordings are so great.
Sort of the other side of the coin, which is bands who went in and spent 3 days getting the tom-tom sounds and ended up with a tired, boring sound. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because they didn't know. They're not Shelly Akis.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So,
absolutely.
There's always that other side of the coin.
Well,
let's hear this and hear these drums in your face a little bit. Yeah.
Someone's gonna tell you lies, cut you down to size. Don't do me like that, don't do me like that. Well, I love you, baby, don't do me like that. Don't do me like that, don't do me like that. Someday I might need you, baby, don't do me like that.
Listen, it's approaching distortion.
Uh-huh.
At times.
It's really bright. Shelley really liked bright records. He really felt that they cut through. In the mastering, I'm sure we didn't make this any brighter, but we also didn't take any of the brightness away. He really liked bright records, and he also felt that bass could be the enemy, that bass slowed up. This was his style in those years. And the thing is with radio, playing a record like this on radio with some of the more primitive radio compression that went on, it usually did bring up the bass a little bit anyway.
Yeah.
So, and he knew that. I mean, he would listen to the radio and... So in the mastering, he would just come up and just make sure that what came out of the studio and what came off that piece of vinyl was going to represent.
Just like the raspberries, you know, it's going to burst out of the radio.
Yeah.
And that's the name of the game. Yeah.
Yeah, and he knew that could be ruined in the mastering. See, that's the thing. It's kind of the hypocritic oath or something, do no harm. I mean, if you're a mastering engineer and you just respect what's done, you'll do well.
I think sometimes people just want to do the opposite, you know. Well, this isn't bassy enough. Whatever isn't there, I'll put there, as opposed to listening and figure out what it needs. You know, that's this record was a huge record. I mean, you must have heard this on the radio every 5 seconds,
yeah.
And must have brought you some clients, I assume.
Yeah, well, that's one of the reasons I brought it in. Not only brought me clients, but it's one of those ones that when guys come in now and they're in their 20s or their 30s and they know my discography from classic rock, they always mention the Petty records, you know. And you know, again, I got to give complete credit to the people who do the recording and the producing of the records. You know, it's
there must be some records though that you saved somebody's ass, right?
There's a lot. There's a lot of records that really need a tremendous amount of help. I mean, what happens with in this era is that people are forced to work in studios. You know, again, I always like to draw the comparison so people can understand what a different climate that we're in right now. But, you know, years ago you had staff engineers who would be at a studio for 10, 12, 15 years and they would know the room perfectly. They'd know the monitors perfectly. Now what happens is an engineer gets hired, the producer engineer gets hired. He has to go to some place in Tennessee to somebody's barn that they just set up a bunch of equipment in. He's got to go record the record in this place that he's never been before. Then he's got to take it to a studio because of a budget that he's never worked in because it's near the guy's house or whatever. It's so totally different.
Yeah.
So those records, a lot of times the mixer will not know what the monitors sound like. So what sounds good in that studio at that time could actually be way, way off. And what I do with all my regular clients is I always tell them, if you're in a new place, send me, before you get deep into the mixes, send me something. I'll tell you where we're at. And I do that, you know, I'm happy to do that.
Because you can, because you know your room like the back of your hand, so you can say your bass is a little lighter.
I've been in my room for 18 years, yeah. And I've been working on the same exact speakers for almost 20 years. Actually, 25 years.
So I think the loudness thing is the worst thing to happen to mastering in the history. What's the best thing? Is there a best thing?
Well, you know, it's the best thing for business, though. It's the worst thing.
Because everyone has to remaster all their records.
Well, it's the best thing for business because the people in the studio, they don't really, for many reasons, they don't want to make that digital file loud enough at the point that they're at, because it's very, very difficult to mix and be able to hear all the distortion that could happen if you make them too loud. I wish I could come up with a good comparison to this, but it's like maybe a racing car driver that if he pushes the car a little bit too hard, he may not hear that the engine is burning up and he doesn't smell it or something, but if he had an expert engine guy with him, he'd know you can't go that fast. That's really what it is. They really don't want to do it, and they leave it to us to do. They leave that last finishing. So it's actually really great for business.
Because now it's just part of the thing. You have it mastered really loud.
And the guy you go to make it loud or to fit. Used to be the guy to finish it, and now it's to finish it but also make it loud. So it's like a kind of a combination of skills. Then there's the corrective aspect, like I was talking about, when the speakers are not known too well. People will call me up and go like, man, I it sounded so great in the studio, but then I've been listening to it at a couple of people's houses, and it's like way too much bass. You got to...
I don't want to get too deep into your business, but how much is mastering? I mean, what is the ballpark we're talking about, what that people spend?
Oh, sure.
Not necessarily you, just generally speaking.
The range for a professional studio like Sterling Sound would be somewhere in the vicinity of $2,500 per album. It could be $3,000. Listen, there's albums that are 38 minutes and there's albums that are 75 minutes. So it's hard
shouldn't
to give
cost
a ballpark.
The same. Yeah, yeah.
But I'd say between $2,500 and $3,500 for professional work.
Yeah.
We have other prices. I personally feel very, very much in favor of supporting jazz as an art form, and I try to really be, I have a kind of like a jazz price. It's an informal price, but first of all, I enjoy working on jazz. I'm not a big jazz fan, but I appreciate what goes into it. The art of recording is really alive in every jazz recording, and musicians in the same room. Microphones are important. Consoles are important. Ambience is important, rooms are important, all the things that were always important are important in that genre. And unfortunately, there's almost no budget for making jazz records. They never sold anyway, and now that nobody's buying records, they really don't sell. So, you know, in that case, I'll go down to in the $2,000 range or whatever. And you know what I always say to people who've been loyal to me? If you don't have any money, I'll do it for free, and I've done many of them for free. Uh-huh. I mean, I have somebody coming in a couple of weeks who's been good to me, and if they need help, I give them help. So, that's kind of like the range. But, you know, the thing is, when budgets were $150,000 for a record, people would spend $2,000 or $3,000 mastering a record. Now, if the budget is $18,000, how could they afford $3,000 for mastering?
That's tough, yeah. Well, what does a recording studio cost? The top of the line, you know, recording studio?
Well, recording studios are actually less expensive than mastering.
Right. They're $1,500 a day plus.
You get the best studios in New York for $1,500 to $1,800 a day. You get great studios outside of New York for $900 a day, $700 a day. I've heard those kind of prices.
But so it adds up real quick.
It adds up, especially if guys can't play. You know, that's the thing. I mean,
last time we were here, you were going back to, you were telling us that you took started taking guitar lessons again.
Yeah.
How's that going?
I have to tolerate my ineptitude, but it's actually it's pretty joyful when it works out pretty good. The thing that I find at my age, though, is that I really can't spend, like, you know, we went away, we were in Italy for like 10 days. My wife and I were in Italy. When I came back, having not played for 10 days, it wasn't like you just picked it right up again. It's a constant, it's like a neurological battle to make the two hands and the mind and the sight reading make it all work at the same time. But what I'm doing is kind of pre-classical. I mean, we're doing exercises that are classical, so I'm reading music again for the first time in 50 years, and watching. You know, I'm doing it really as a combination of a brain exercise, and it's not to perform or anything. But I've just been noticing then when I just play informally, that I really am playing 1,000 times better than I was playing before the lesson. So it's really good. My teacher is very patient.
You mentioned 15 years or whatever in the same room now. I know that you guys are moving from Manhattan as Manhattan is getting just insane.
Yeah, we have to leave the city after almost 50 years in business in New York. We're going to go to two locations. We're going to be building a studio in Nashville, small studio in Nashville, and a medium-sized studio in Edgewater, New Jersey, right on the other side of the river.
I mean, I know your room is perfect, and part of what makes why people bring a record to you is because your room is just the way you want it.
Yeah.
But are you at all excited about getting to do over, to start from scratch?
Well, we're working with Fran Manzella, who's the designer who worked on the Sterling that we built in the 2000. And the rooms are going to have pretty much the same concept, and I think they're going to be just marginally smaller and maybe different window position. I'm really confident that the rooms are going to be as good or better. I think the rooms will be better in relation to 2000 than my ears are. So, hopefully,
room will last longer than you.
Yeah, I think so. No, I'm kind of kidding.
Are you slowing down?
No, I mean the thing with the listening is that it's just a constant battle with the listening for the amount of highs that people like. It's the durability of the high end. It's like I need a certain volume to be able to listen to the record, and then when people really love high end, and drummers love hitting those cymbals. So that's the part of the job. I can hear good, but I'm getting a little too sensitive.
It's like reading glasses for your ears. You need to, but you can't really mix a record with a hearing aid, can you?
No, just old drummers, lay off those cymbals. Thank you.
Yeah. Greg Calbee has been our guest for the second time today. If you missed our first conversation, it's over at WFMU.org/Michael. It is the June 11th episode. You can get information about Greg at sterling-sound.com. And we may do this even again sometime because it's so much fun. Don't forget that Carl Blau joins us October 15th. Amy Rigby, November 12th. I got some other things cooking, so check WFMU.org/Michael for that. Greg, it's been super fun. Thank you.
My pleasure.
Thanks for bringing all your records.
Okay. See you next time.
Yes, indeed. Folks, it's WFMU. We start on WMFU, Mount Hope and Rockin' County, 91.9 FM, online, WFMU.org.
Ever get the feeling you've been cheated? Good night.